Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of The Next Stage. This week we are very excited to have a world champion, Kenny Sillman, track and field. Kenny has, you know, traveled the world, one of the kindest, most incredible, determined guys I've ever met. You know, I heard his story back in December, and just hearing about pushing past obstacles and injuries, and there are a lot of correlations that you could relate to. And so we're very excited to have you on the show today, Kenny, and can't wait to get this going.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Thank you, TJ.
Well, all right, let's get into it. Now, Kenny, you're in Atlanta?
Yes, I am in Atlanta right now. I'm back in my hometown.
Right on. All right, and so just some background on Kenny. His 400-meter hurdle world champion in 2018, correct?
Yeah, so there was a thing, there was a World Cup. It was a new initiative, like, in track and field, when you say world champion, it kind of automatically connects you to, like, the actual world championships. It was not that. It was the same level.
Okay.
But it was not, like, the world championship. This was, like, the World Cup.
But I was a
world champion in that sense. But it's hard. You don't want to conflate the two of them. But, yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay. But, and so 400-meter hurdles, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's, like, one of the hardest – that is, like, one of the two hardest events in track and field, correct? Like, that and the 800, right? Or, like, the two, like, most difficult I've heard?
Yes. I mean, that is definitely the argument, and people still argue to this day whether or not the 800 or the 400 hurdles is the harder event. I mean, I've run the 400 hurdles at a high level, and I also ran 800 when I was a lot younger. And a lot of people would say the 400 hurdles is the hardest, but knowing what I know about the 400 hurdles and knowing what I know about the 800, I would not ever want to do the 800. I think it's just such a tough event. But those two are definitely at the top.
That's awesome, though. That's crazy. I just think it's really cool to have you on the show just because, I mean, I'm a big fan of just great athletes in general, so that it's an honor for you to be on.
Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah. So, and you're an Olympic hopeful. So what is that like for you right now, kind of in this limbo of basically everything got delayed a year, right?
With this year being COVID and you got, what's it looking like, you know, the Olympics being pushed back?
Yeah. So I'll back it up. So last year, I guess this is 2020. So 2019, I made a big decision to come back to Atlanta. And because I stayed in Chapel Hill after I graduated in 2018 and trained there for a year. But things kind of didn't really work out. The coach that I had, we didn't really – I mean, we were great. He's an awesome coach. And, I mean, I actually won my first national title with him. But I think, you know, to move me to the next level, it wasn't exactly where I wanted to be. And so I had to make some changes. So I decided to come back home, and I found a great coach. His name is Nat Page, and he coaches at Georgia Tech. And so I made the move back to Atlanta in August of 2019, and then I started training in October. And so October 2019, I started training, and it was incredible. I mean, this coach was giving me the most intense training I've ever had in my life. I mean, you know, we were doing mileage, we were doing, 800 repeats, you know, just over distance stuff that I've never done before as far as my fall training goes. But it definitely allowed me to establish an incredible base. And so so that was good. So, you know, moving along in November, December. And so we come around January. We're now starting to get into, like, you know, race type of shape. We're trying to speed up the training, you know, do less repeats, less over distance stuff, and more hurdle specific stuff. And so, guys, it was going great. I mean, I honestly felt as though I was in the best shape of my life. I mean, things were, I think my steps were hitting, everything was hitting just how it should. And so we had plans to start on March 20th. And March, I think it was announced to the NCAA or like whenever. I mean, track and field coincides very closely with the NCAA because there's not a lot of professional meets domestically. So you have to do a lot of get the start going. But anyway, so I think the NCAA announced that they were cutting everything off on like March 12th, maybe, or it was the week before my first meet was scheduled. And so I literally had, you know, started to taper, started to like, you know, back off of things and like really got ready to run. And then they were like, yeah, no, you know, coronavirus is here. So, that was terrible. I mean, that was tough. And so with that, you know, when they first announced that, there was still some gray area as to whether the Olympics will still be a thing, whether or not, you know, we're going to have a season this year. So that was kind of still up in the air. So we still had to train. But it got to a point where we started to feel unsafe. You know, the more and more information that came out about coronavirus, the more fear everybody got. But we still also had a job to do, you know. Yeah. Like I still
had to train during we're still athletes.
We're still athletes, exactly. And you guys can relate very closely to this. But, like, I had to, like, you know, I needed to train. And I wasn't going to be the person that if they had the Olympics, you know, I wasn't ready. Mm-hmm. And so it's a tough thing kind of protecting the athlete from himself, but him or herself. But so I still trained. They moved the Olympics, and I'll just kind of wrap it up. They moved the Olympics. And so it allowed me to make a decision whether or not we wanted to train. Like, can we train safely? Do we even have a track to train on? But we now had the comfort of, you know, the Olympics would not be this year. So we got pushed back a little bit. So it's been weird. I've still been in this like little limbo period, kind of like we decreased our amount of training, but not the intensity. And so we're still kind of waiting to see if there's going to be anything later this year. But as of now, it's looking like there's going to be nothing.
Okay. So you guys,
nothing at all this year.
Wait, say that again. Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Nothing at all this year. No racing.
Well, so they're saying there is stuff. You know, so overseas in Europe, they are hoping for meat, and I mean hoping for meats. Like the Diamond League has come out and said they're going to have a season from, you know, August, September, October, and that's the hope. But it's you know, they also haven't given very many details as far as, like, you know, how the meats will be conducted. Will you have to be tested? What events are you even having? I mean, there's a lot of, you know, still just kind of lack of clarity that, you know, still gives us comfort. So as far as me and my coach, we're making a decision pretty soon here. We're going to decide whether or not we want to keep the season going or not, because, you know, it gets to a point where just to train is more detrimental than it is, you know, positive. I'm sure you guys can understand.
Yeah, it's actually, we're almost in a identical situation of, like, we have dates for races that may happen, but at the same time, you know, things like they'll put a date and then next thing you know, it'll get canceled, and then they'll put a new date, and then you're like, okay, I can't really believe in any of this. But at the same time, like, I'm still training quite hard, because when it does come time, like, you don't have time to, like, oh, go through a whole training cycle. Like, you have to be ready when they say go.
Exactly. You got to be ready when they say go, 100%.
So, Kenny, what have you been doing then to, like, stay motivated during, I guess, that time? Or so with us, when cycling, we have this software called Go Zwift, and they also have it for, like, runners. But they've been setting up, like, e-racing to keep, like, Tyler does it every Tuesday.
Oh, wow.
And it keeps, you know, so it's, you basically connect your bike to the trainer, like you saw me when we did that photo shoot.
Yeah.
Where the bike connects to the trainer, and you know, we race against people online, and that software, you have the ability to do connected to your treadmill, correct, Tyler?
I believe so, yeah.
Is there something like that, like, for running, or have they talked about that? Because that's been even talks for cycling, you know, especially this year, like, you know, they've done quite a few races for even the pros.
Oh, wow. Yes. I've heard, there's definitely been talks around potential for, and what that looks like is beyond me. Apparently, they would send you a timing system. You would get a chip, and, you know, allegedly they would start at this, or not allegedly, but, like, you know, hopefully they would start at the same time, and it would be recorded, and like, you know, everybody's conditions would obviously be different, but, you know, you just got to, like, you know, take that out and try to make it as absolute as possible. But yeah, there's talks of virtual meets. But that is, I don't think that's too similar to what you guys do. It sounds like what you guys seem to be having is more consistent and, like, a little bit easier to do. So no, we don't have anything like that. And I think that's been the tough thing about this all, is that a lot of people don't have tracks at all. You know, like so many, like I said before, so many people depend on the college, like, community to have a professional career. And when, you know, NCAA has, you know, or not even NCAA, but, like, these conferences have, like, put so many strict rules on their facilities during this time, people have been kicked off of tracks. And then public tracks are now closing. And so, I mean, there's so many, like, you know, the discrepancy between who has an ability to train and who does not is way too, you know, vast for them to like try and do something that seems fair. You know, like most things just don't seem fair because people don't have tracks. And so it's tough to try and keep up with someone else because, you know, it's really what's around you. And so what I've been doing, I mean, you know, we have a small training group and we've been fortunate enough to have, that's not true. We got kicked off of our track when everything first stopped. And so then we found another public track, got kicked off of that one. We found another public track that kind of had a hole in it. And so a bunch of people were like, you know,
my gosh, through the hole. Sounds like skateboarding in the 90s, like searching for the spot, yeah, man.
So it was very much of that. I mean, we got kicked off of five tracks in Atlanta and but didn't miss a beat, which I think is a testament to like our dedication. But, you know, we didn't miss a beat. We had a small group and we always practiced social distancing. We always definitely were cognizant of the virus. By no means were we reckless. But, you know, we still wanted to train because, you know, first of all, you have to train. You know, it's not like even if, and I'm sure you guys can relate to this too, even if they call the season off right now, we would still have to train or do something.
Yeah, you still have to train until next season. Yeah, you can't just stop.
Yeah, like you can't just stop.
Well, and it's biologically, right. I feel like we've done it for so long now and at such a level that if I don't ride at least once a day, like just ride my bike and my body's not doing that motion, I feel so off. The body feels off, you know? And so, I mean, you just start doing things at such a level and you just have to kind of keep doing it or tweak it in a way to kind of keep those same sensations.
Exactly, 100%. And so that's definitely what we've been trying to do, trying to keep the pace. But, you know, it is getting to a point where it's kind of we're moving far into the summer. Like, you know, we're moving a little bit further along and we got to make some hard decisions coming here soon.
Yeah. One other question I have for you. You said that you rely a lot on like the colleges and universities to like provide that the tools necessary to train, even though you're no longer in college. What is it? And as like a national team athlete, what is that like? What is that support structure like as far as from like the USOC and just as like the national track and field team? And like, how does that work as far as like supporting? Because I mean, I'm assuming that this is your full-time job more or less, right? So like how does that work as like an Olympic level athlete? Like how does that all come together for you?
Yeah. So to answer that completely, I got to back it up, I guess. So coming out of college is pretty much, I mean, unfortunately, and I don't know if this is for cycling or not, but coming out of college, if you get a contract, if you get a contract out of college and you are, you know, fortunate enough to run fast enough and like perform at a high enough level and prove yourself to be sponsored and get a contract out of college, then you are extremely lucky, mm-hmm. you know, and I hate using lucky because it's not luck, but like there are a lot of people who do not get this opportunity and who may be fast but perform at the wrong times, et cetera. And so there's two categories of athletes, honestly. I mean, there's more than two, but let's keep it two just to keep it basic. There's the athletes who have contracts and who do not have contracts. The athletes who do have contracts, who come out of college and get those contracts, are usually pretty big contracts. And so they're able to do this full time and kind of get signed right away. And so to speak to that, like I was one of those athletes. I was able to perform well out of college and I won a national title on a senior level outside of college, so I was able to get picked up by Spider, which was incredible. So that allowed me, you know, financial security to do this full time. So that's that on that. But to speak as far as
lots of love, Spider,
Spider Korea, baby, you know how we do.
Lots of love.
So getting picked up by them was unreal. But let's say I did not have, you know, so USA Track and Field, that's our governing body, and so they, you know, USA Track and Field, that's who you run for on the national team.
Right.
So if you, they have like a tier system is what it's called. And so they have multiple levels. TPP is like the talent protection program. And there's like tier one, two, and three. So TPP, they give that, they give funding to athletes who come out of college who are like a certain ranking in the world. And so they give you, you know, healthcare, they give you like stipends, they give you medical funds, all that kind of stuff. But it's only, it's, I mean, it's like, I think it's less than like you know, 1% of the athletes who come out of, who like graduate or like who graduate college, like turn pro and get that kind of type of support. So USA Track and Field does support us, but by no means is the money they give enough to sustain yourself. So if you don't have a contract, then you really can be, you know, kind of left hanging, which is why a lot of people have to go and train at colleges, because you know, most people stick around because your college knows who you are. You can get free you know, training. You can get free health work from, what am I, a PT training. You get all like free massages. They keep you in the system essentially, and they keep your costs down. So it's just very tough. There's not a lot of money in the sport, and so USA Track and Field definitely supports us, but by no means is it enough money to like live by yourself, which is why a lot of people stay around where they went to college.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Is it like? So in your opinion, like, because the NCAA is always kind of like in the news for whether or not they support their athletes well enough. And you, like, obviously you can look at like the team sports, like football and basketball. And that's a lot more, I don't know. I think that's pretty one-sided argument at this point, but from like your perspective with the track and field stuff, like, do you feel like the NCAA athletes get enough support from their universities?
So within, like, when you're in school or when you're, I mean, I'm assuming you say, like, when you're in school.
Yeah, I mean, I would say in general, because it seems like those benefits continue on with you after you graduated, right?
So, yes, exactly. I think, like, those are two separate questions. So, like, does the NCAA support its athletes? Within school, like, I think that's a whole different thing. I mean, the way I feel about that, is very like in line with how most people feel about it. Like the whole thing going on right now, like, does NCAA allow their athletes to make money? Do they, like, you know, what are their interests? I think it's all a bit of, you know, baloney. I think that, yeah,
absolutely,
the NCAA does not allow their athletes to, you know, use their likeness, and things have recently, within the last year, as we know, been turned around. So I think that, like, you know, we're seeing a change right now. But like when you're in school, I think it's a little bit different. But like also when you're out of school, there's no support. So I don't want to get confused with what I'm saying. When you stay at your college, it's entirely up to your college. So independently from the NCAA, if your college and like coaching staff will allow you to stay around, then you can.
Gotcha.
But it has nothing to do with like the NCAA. Nothing to do with that. It's really just about if your college likes you enough to
continue like to support you. Honestly. Right. Okay.
Right.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's wild. So Kenny, right now you're out in Atlanta, you move back home. I remember last year in December you told me you had an injury, you pulled your hamstring, and what's it like being back home? I mean, you're back home now in Atlanta, feel comfortable, you're able to recover from that injury. You even said that you built up a better fitness than ever this year. Then COVID hit, and then, you know, you feel all these frustrations towards, you know, losing the Olympics and like where to channel all that. And then all of a sudden, within the last week, everything happens, you know, with Black mm-hmm. Lives Matters out in Atlanta. I mean, I just want to hear everything, man. I mean, tell us what it's like out there. I've seen your posts that you've been going to a lot of the protests, and I mean, you're an athlete that at its top of his sport, you know, and highly respected, I feel like. And I just think that's so cool. And I, you know, love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's a lot. I mean, number one, like how, you know, when you talk about sports and like, you know, my injuries and like, you know, having to do with coronavirus and the halting of my season, all that stuff. And then you throw in, you know, these like Black Lives Matter, like the whole movement of racial injustice and like trying to fix it all. It's a lot. So you got to compartmentalize, you know, I mean, like, you know, and that's one thing that I think.
It's kind of like a spiritual quest, I feel like, for everyone right
absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely. I mean, people.
Where you had this thing people built up for, and then now it's like, well, now something really that like the world that kind of pulled the curtain is like, whoa, here's what actually really matters
right.
now.
And yeah, and that's so interesting. And I think that's a question that a lot of people are trying to figure out right now is, I know like within the Black community, one, it's like, you know, how long will this last? Because here's the thing is, racial injustice has been going on for a long time. You know, like racism, like, you know, the country is founded on systemic race or on racism, which has allowed for systemic racism to, you know, prevail for so long. And so this stuff has been going on for a long time. I mean, I had a talk with some of my friends, my white friends in particular, and I just kind of laid out to them. I was like, look, like, you know, this stuff has been going on forever. You know, like black people have been hunted by the police. And to put it so raw, I do that on purpose. You know, when you know, from slavery, when black people would, you know, leave, you know, run away from the cotton farm, you know, run away from the plantations, you know, there are people out there that went to go and, you know, go and capture them and deal with them how they may. Yeah. So that stuff happens. And so then you fast forward a few hundred years and you come to, like, you know, the, like 1968 was when Jim Crow ended. So about 100 years before that was Jim Crow era. And so, you know, people were punished and lynched and, you know, fought after for drinking out of the wrong, you know, the wrong water fountain. And so then you bring it all the way to now, and you've got, you know, George Floyd being killed in plain sight with no justification for a counterfeit, you know, $20 bill. So the point in saying all that is, like, you know, this stuff's been going on for a long time, and black people have been seeing this because it is our reality for a long time. And so now that things are kind of being woken up and things are kind of being brought to the forefront, it's a beautiful thing. And, like, and it needs to happen. Why is it happening now? You know, that's a whole different question. I don't think it's important. I think the fact that it is happening is more so where the focus should be at. Mm-hmm. And so, so yeah, it's crazy. I mean, it's crazy. But dealing with all that is just, it's tough, because for someone like myself, you know, I've been fortunate in my life. I've been very fortunate. My parents, you know, my parents are married. They've been married, and, you know, they've done well for themselves as far as their business. Like, they never have financial struggles. And so in my life, you know, like growing up, my childhood, you know, at times I find myself at a weird, you know, unique intersection, you know. So on one road in my childhood, athletics, my upbringing, all that type of stuff, I ride with black people, you know, like my whole life has been, you know, growing up in that way with black people. But then once my parents decided they want a better life for my brother and I, they sent us to a private school. And so since I've gone to that private school, now I ride with all white people. And so I constantly ride those two roads all the time. And so I have a crazy perspective on the two communities, and it allows me to kind of see the disparity and the differences on, like, why certain things don't align. And so it's been really cool for me in times like this to just kind of understand both sides very clearly. And but it also, you know, it also puts a type of pressure on me to talk to both sides in ways in which they can understand what's truly going on, you know, black and white people. And so it's been interesting, you know, having my platform, being able to share with so many people how I feel about this, because, you know, I think a lot of this stuff that comes on, that, you know, a lot of racism that goes on in the majority has to do with ignorance. I think a lot of people just don't understand. A lot of white people just do not understand the racism that exists in the world, and you know, whether it's their own fault or not, you know, being silent about it and allowing it to happen is enabling the system to, you know, further discriminate. And so it's been just nice to be able to have a platform, be able to kind of speak my truth to my white friends who, you know, believe in me, who trust me, and who, you know, think the world of me. But then kind of explain to them, like, you know, you think this of me, and I appreciate that, and I'm very intentional with how you view me, but you got to understand that, you know, I'm also black too, and, like, you know, everybody doesn't view me like you view me. And so you got to understand that the world out there is not as kind to someone who looks like me that you may be. So it's a lot. It's a crazy time, but I definitely try to use my platform in a way to speak to people who trust me, who I believe really have good in their hearts, just don't know what's really going on in the world.
I think one thing that you said that is super important, awesome, to, like, recognize, and it's something that I've recognized more in recent years of my life as well, is, like, before we got on live, TJ was saying how he's like, you know, we're two white guys, he and I, and we're not, don't have any racism. We don't think like that. Like, that's not part of who we are. But right. It doesn't mean that it doesn't go on and it's not someone else's reality. And you mentioned perspective, having right. had relationships with a very like white portion of the population and a black portion of the population, and how that gives you a different point of view on the world, and also a very unique opportunity to be the voice to like explain to both sides and be like that bridge that can help you know get that message across. And it's something that I actually resonate quite a bit with, because my team now that I'm with is owned by two black guys. It's the only black professional cycling team in America, and I'm pretty sure in the world. Yeah,
in the world.
And,
in the world.
So, you know, Justin, who's the team owner, he grew up in South Central LA, but cycling is a super white sport, obviously. And so right. he got, you know, he came from South Central LA, but then was exposed to this new culture of, you know, like, I guess you could say like upper middle class, like white people sport. And I think he has right. a very similar perspective to you in the sense that he developed these relationships with white people, and especially hearing his stories and like hearing it come from a perspective that like he has, that of someone I love and respect, to me, that made it more real as a white guy, because right. like you said, like it, a lot of racism maybe does come from ignorance and just not knowing. Can you hear me? Oh, we lost him.
Can you
can edit that.
We lost 30, him.
35 minutes. I dropped an F bomb in there too. Let's see if we can get him back. I was on my roll.
Oh man, I'm loving it. I'm loving it. What it 34, did you write? 50. Yeah, 35 minutes. I'll just write. It was.
See if we can get him back. Hopefully. I was on a roll. I love talking to this guy. He's incredible. No, man. This is my favorite podcast we ever did. He's back.
Oh, my
dude,
God.
Dude, Kenny,
so,
you're
okay,
back,
so,
man. We're back.
I didn't realize that I was connected. So I wanted to get this article that I was about to reference to Tyler's point. And it was online, and so I picked up my phone to look at it. And I guess it took me – I didn't realize that if I exited the screen, I was going to leave the recording. So sorry about
that. It's all good.
That's cool, man. We're cool. We're just stoked to be back talking.
Yeah,
Tyler,
I was getting
– like,
yeah,
we're
no,
on a roll,
so,
man. This is awesome.
It's something that's become, like, important to me to like, voice as, like, as a white person is, and someone who grew up almost exclusively around white people. So it was never my reality to even really witness racism. And I think now that I have that relationship with Justin and his family, and I can hear it, to me, it makes it more real. And I think that having that perspective, and now as a white person, is equally, I feel like, my responsibility to be like, no, look, this is a problem. It's not my problem, but it's the problem of someone I care about or friends I care about and other people who I don't exactly. know, but it's not a white black issue. It's a white wrong. It's a right wrong issue now. And
exactly.
And
yeah,
it's humanity,
and so I really
man.
I
it's
appreciate
a human
I
issue.
You voice it so well, and I appreciate your perspective on that, because I think that you know, like, having someone with your background and having you can really, I think you people like you have such an important role in this too, because you have such a good relationship with white people to be like, right. no, look, this is a problem, and you can get them to listen, and I think people need to listen. And so
right.
it starts with people like you reaching out to people like TJ and myself. And then it's up to us to equally like be a advocate for the cause and
right.
for what's right.
Right. I mean, 100%. And it's so interesting because, you know, there's so many ways that that me as a black man can feel about this, you know, like because in one sense, it's like, I could be tired of explaining. I could be tired of, you know, this whole, because this has been going on forever. Like, you know, I've experienced racism my whole life, whether it's microaggression, whether it's, you know, just all implicit stuff, or whether it's like blatant, like, you know, hatred. Mm-hmm. And I will say I've experienced less of that and more of just like the implicit stuff. But to my point, it all still exists. And so in one way you can be like, yo, I don't want to talk about this. You know, like I'm tired of it. You know, white people, you need to wake up and understand and like, and you know, figure it out yourself. That is one way that a black man can feel. And I think it's justified. You know, I think that, like, you know, it gets to a point where you are just so fed up that you don't want to explain things anymore. And you feel it's incumbent upon the oppressor to do their own research and figure out like what has been systemically, you know, created that has allowed this all to happen. So that is one perspective to have. But then I think there's also another perspective to have that I have is that, you know, the two, like, we can coexist, like you know, and we can be more than coexist. We can all be friends, because I've experienced it firsthand, you know.
Yeah.
Like there is work to be done here, but it can be done. And so I think it's so important for people like myself to that kind of have relationship with both parties to give their story and allow the understanding that, you know, this is my truth. This is what I experience, and I need you to understand that, like, if you respect me and you want to be a part of me and you like me, you must also understand this,
right?
Because this is my reality, and this is what's going on. And so, yeah. You know, I think it's important for people like myself to also control the narrative, because, you know, when you tell a white person to go research and go do this all by yourself and you know, go figure it out, well, number one, you know, you want them to have a reason to do it. You know, people aren't just going to go and seek stuff out just to seek stuff out. And I mean, and you would hope they would, but, you know, we're human. We got stuff to go on. We got stuff to do. Like you want them to understand that, like, this is a reality for a lot of people. So one, you have to make the personal connection. And then two, you also want to make sure that you control what they're learning, you know, because you know, like, for example, one of the big systemic problems within the world is whitewashed, you know, history.
Absolutely.
And like
I was about to say that. I mean, would that start right with our history books, man?
Right, exactly. So
rewrite all that. Rewrite everything. Those were written when slaves were around. Exactly. You know what I mean? So
right, no credit.
And gives so no credit.
When you go and tell a white person to go do their own research, I mean, like, you should, and white people should do that, and you need to educate yourself. Because, I mean, you know, that's the best educator. Like, sometimes you got to learn for yourself, but also try and steer them in directions that, you know, they can go. And and if you don't know necessarily, then, like, just talk about it. Like, have the dialogue, have the conversation, because you want to make sure that your input is heard for the first time. You know, a lot of times we aren't heard, and you know, there are perspectives that are given that are still whitewashed and still don't include black people. But you want to make sure there's a time where you get to a point where it's like, yo, like, listen to me too. You know, like hear me, hear what I have to say. And let's do this together, because, you know, we can't exist. And that's been the cool part about this whole thing. You know, me growing up around a lot of white people, like, I have incredible trust and incredible, like, brotherhood with white people. And so, you know, there's times where I've been with friends and they would say certain things that would come off as, you know, I was, you know, they would say like a certain comment. I'm like, ooh, like, you know, that's a little racist. Like, you know, okay. You know, you said something kind of messed up, but then everything beyond that was not racist. You know, like, so, like, you know, I had nothing to justify them being a racist person beyond, like, that one racist comment.
A comment out of ignorance.
Exactly. Just, a comment out of pure ignorance. And
just,
so I think it's important to distinguish that.
Yeah.
Like, you have to know.
So I think that brings up a good thing with social media right now and with everything going on and, you know, so many people. I mean, I kind of took my time to post something and took my time to kind of absorb everything and listen and absorb what's going on and feel it. And you kind of were just like, all right, what's, you know, how do you do this? And how do you make people feel comfortable to talk about it? You know, because, like I said, I've never really experienced ever racism or anything here, but I'm, you know, super white, and it's like, you'd not, you know? And so it's like, you're afraid to talk about something, even though you don't, right, like, you don't believe in racism, you know? And so you know, or Justin, you know, people that we're all friends with, and, you know, then people that, you know, I see would see your post and you'd be like, hey, reach out, let's talk about this, you know. And I'm an open guy. I love to talk. I love to have raw discussions. I love to have real discussions. That's kind of the artist within me is, you know, and that's kind of where I've put my narrative. I've kind of stopped talking about it on social media because I felt like eventually I didn't want to feel like I was jumping on a bandwagon. So I found other ways to push my voice. And so I've been working on, you know, a painting, you know, a very powerful painting, and putting all my emotion into that. And I feel like that's kind of, you know, how do we almost move away from posting and actually changing the world, you know, changing, putting it in the history books, or, you know, how does the protesting and how does, you know, the Blackout Tuesday, how does this actually translate to something that matters, and, like, you know, where it's eliminating racism? How do we, you know, I mean, that's a massive toll to end that question to ask you, but like you said, dude, is it just rewriting history? Is it being more open?
I had a conversation with a friend the other day. I'm a white friend, and he said something that really struck me. And like, we kind of were, you know, just talking, and when he said this, I was like, ooh, I was like, that's it, you know? So basically what he said, he was like, he was asking me on advice on what to do and, you know, how to move and, you know, how can he be better, you know, move away from social media, all that, which are great questions. But I think one thing that he said, you know, what's your influence? You know, what's your platform? You know, who can you reach and who trusts you? And like, you know, where are you on a daily basis? Because at the end of the day, that's what it is. You can't expect someone who has, you know, 900 followers on Instagram to reach the whole world with a post, you know? But the way I feel like that's not the point, you know? The point is not to post on social media and hope to change the world. I don't think that should be the way it should be looked at. The point is for the people who follow you, the people who support you, and the people who acknowledge you, you need them to know that you don't stand for this, you know? Because like, what is a small post really going to do in the grand scheme of things? Well, it does more than you think, because if you have friends, like, for example, my white friends, you know, there are white people within their circles who are racist. And who, you know, there are some that are very, a few that are probably actually racist, or, you know, to their heart, but also just a lot of ignorance in the majority that exists. So if you use your platform, whether it's social media, whether it's a podcast, whether it's a conversation, whether it's a painting, whatever it is, like whatever your influence, like if you're a coach, whether it's like, you know, talking to your athletes, whatever your reach is, it's important for you to be vocal within your influence, because then you can wake up people. Now people know where you stand, and then with like now people know where you stand, they have to make a decision. And now people are either revealed as, you know, being on the right side of this or being on the wrong side of this. But we need that to happen so that people can understand that the majority is going this way. Either you understand, like wake up, see what's going on, or you get left behind. And so I think it's very important to realize what's your influence, who can you reach directly and that'll trust you. And then work within that circle, and then you can go bigger than that. But you can't expect, you know, and I think it's, you know, unrealistic. Or I really dislike the argument of people like, yeah, I don't want to post because, you know, it's you know, what am I really doing? Well, okay, then don't post. But find out who is following you, find out where the eyes are, and then sit within that and try and create change within that little space.
I love that. Yeah, that was really great. It.
I love it.
Yeah. I think that's important. I mean, that's what we need to hear, man. To know how we can be better. That's what everyone needs to hear. To Black people as well. I think like what you just said, that is, I think a lot of people are looking for like, okay, well, what can we do? And what, how does this continue? And I think, thank you for saying that. That was amazing. I think one other thing is, as athletes, I think, you know, you've kind of seen in the news, especially like, in athletics and celebrity athletes are like kind of like leading the charge, I think, with this. In my opinion, I think that is because, you know, athletics is almost like the closest thing to having that fair playing field, at least for those, you know, between the whistles or when the gun goes off for the, You know, like that is when it is. There is no racism. It's like one on one, man versus man, woman versus woman, and that's what it is. And best person win, right? And I think that is like kind of led to like the start of white people even really like acknowledging and learning about this is because like when your teammate or your training partner, you know, you develop that relationship with them that goes so far beyond color that you know, we have the fortunate experience to really be able to, like, I think, push past that color barrier a lot easier. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think sports is that is the fair playing, like the most fair playing field that we have, you know, and it's not entirely fair because, you know, certain sports obviously aren't as welcoming to certain communities, mm-hmm. you know, due to a lot of different factors, you know. We can get into that. I mean, like, you know, I don't even know if this is true or not, but like, maybe cycling isn't as, you know, or isn't as diverse as it could be because, you know, having to get a very nice bike costs a lot of money.
Absolutely.
Lacrosse, you need to do so much equipment and stuff like, you know, stuff like that. So like, sports aren't as fair as they could be, but let's speak on the ones that are and the ones that do have that diversity. Yes. I mean, I think that it's a beautiful thing. That sports provides, and I think it's so. But you know, I've gone back and forth on this because you can't expect an athlete, and I think in the Jordan documentary it said this very well. Like, you know, Jordan got to be who he was because he was very good at what he did. He was the best basketball player. You know, I'm a LeBron fan, but like, you know, allegedly to ever live. But he got to where he was because of how good he was. But that shouldn't be that shouldn't come with an obligation to speak on, you know, social issues that you may not be as well versed on. I think it's tough to require athletes to take a stand on certain things that they may not be as versed on. So like, I go back and forth on my opinion on that.
Yeah.
But to my point that I want to say is, I think right now in history, right, like in this very moment right now, I think it could not be more clear. I think, you know, making a stance right now is very easy to do and also is very necessary because the thing is, let's sit in that ignorance vein. You know, the ignorance exists in a lot of white people, but everyone watches sports. And so you support, you know, these black players, you support their, you know, their performances, their entertainment, but then, you know, you leave them there and you forget about them. When they go into the real life and have to deal with these injustices and these inequalities and all that type of stuff that still happens. And so I think sports, you know, although it is hard and you almost don't want to ruin the space and like, you know, the euphoria that that sports can bring, but you have to because people won't listen unless you do. You know, you have to, you know, protests can't be in black neighborhoods. You know, you can't protest where the problem is. Yeah. You have to go where people, you know, you can't just expect
everyone there already knows who the problem is.
Everyone there already knows what the problem is, you know? And so I think, you know, sports is beautiful to where it merges those two groups very well. And it also, it makes you feel like, you know, racism doesn't exist, which is a beautiful thing. But at this point right now, I think it's so important to use that platform to wake people up.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Have you been contacting any of your sponsors or supporters about, like, doing possible, like, things like that and to support it? Or to, you know,
do
collaborations or
cool
rad things like
so
that?
So, not necessarily, like, Spider. I've not, like, reached out to Spider about certain things. And more so, not because they're exempt from this, but, like, it's... I feel this is like an American issue. Not that, like, you know, I feel like Spider, they could help out and they'd be willing to help. And I've seen, you know, people who support Spider, people from South Korea that even have posts about Black Lives Matter. But that's not the route I want to go necessarily. So as far as like what I've done on like a bigger scale, I've not done anything of that sort. I mean, I don't have like crazy amounts of sponsor. And so I haven't like reached out to certain, like, you know, the few that I do have. But I think like where I want to work right now is very much like, you know, in my inner circles and because I have a wide reach within like my network. and I have a lot of trust within there, but I also have a lot of powerful people in that circle that have influence beyond me. And so I've been having those conversations, and like, you know, we've done initiatives where like for example, one of my best friends, his dad is like the owner of the Falcons. And so him and I have great conversations about, you know, what can be done within the city of Atlanta, and how can we move things out that way. And I mean, he's a brilliant mind, too, my awesome. Best friend. We're getting those conversations going, but it's hard to move because you want to be careful and you want to make sure that you're clear and genuine with your message. But you also, I mean, you do want to get things going because the mm-hmm. time is now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's that delicate line between training and, you know, like what are you like doing right now? You know, are you still training every single day? Are you, I mean, like I said, I've seen you post that you've been at the protests and everything like that. Like has this been like a delay and like, all right, I need to put a pause on training and put my priorities more towards this? Or
I think that's one of the toughest balances right now that I think pretty much all athletes are facing. And I think you're even seeing it right now in the NBA as far as them deciding on coming back or not, because, you know, because they want to play and you want to make money and you have obligations. But there's also like what feels like could be a revolution going on right now. And
It's history, man. It's history. It's hard to comprehend. I feel like competing right now when history is going on.
On my scale of things, I'm still training. Since the pandemic has begun, I've been on 3 times a week opposed to 5 times a week. So we've like decreased our hours essentially, but we've kept the intensity up. So and we've been fortunate enough to like be able to bounce around from track to track. So I haven't stopped training, but I also still have a lot of time. You know, like my training is 2 hours a day, and it's 3 times a week. So by no means is it taking up the majority of my hours. So I've still had a lot of time to kind of be in these movements and just like educate myself and like speak to people and have conversations and work on things in the free time. But I gotta say I haven't stopped training because that is kind of like an outlet. As hard as training may be for us, you know, it's working on your body. You're mental getting better. Outlet, you're avoiding, it's kind of like our safe haven. So I haven't stopped training, but I will say it's getting to a point where my coach and I, we've discussed if we don't have enough clarity on what the season's going to look like within the next few weeks or so, we're going to go ahead and just call it and start preparing for next year because there's no point in, because like if there's going to be no truce, like even if there's going to be meets and they won't count towards your actual ranking stuff because it's an unfair playing field, you'd be almost better, I mean not better off, but like you could get the same type of thing done doing time trials locally than trying to travel and like continue to train for, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. But to your point, I've still been training, but still but like those are very small hours. But allowed myself to definitely be involved with the movement and have those things going on.
Cool.
It's incredible. So if you call the season, what, you take a month off to, what would you do? A month off of training and then jump back into it?
This is a stickler point for a lot of track athletes. Some people think it's impossible to take like 2 months off. Some people think it's impossible to take, 3 months off, or some people think it's crazy just to have like a week off. I typically take 2 months off. If I can get 2 solid months off just to myself I know.
Oh my god. Is that long? That's so anti-cycling. anti-cycling, I feel like. I feel like a cyclist takes an hour off his bike and is like, oh my gosh, I need to go out and train more because it's such I feel like that way.
But I think everybody's different. I think no one's right or wrong. If it works for you, then it works. Yeah. If it doesn't, then it doesn't. But I know for a fact that I've never ever put like all my eggs in one basket. And if I ever, I couldn't imagine having to train for, 12 months out of the year with no break. I would actually hate the sport.
Yeah. It's
I think the breaks are important. We're normally like, I don't know, I feel like standardized for us is like around like 3 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks usually. Be like max.
Okay.
But
jeez.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't. That is just too. I mean, because this stuff isn't easy. And I guess cycling is different on your body than like as far as the impact. Like, track is not. I mean, track is very more. Yeah, yeah. So like that kind of
stuff. Yeah, there's no impact.
You'll get hurt if you continue to just kind of play that kind of stuff. But I'm sure you guys have your own set of variables to deal with as well. So it's not to say it's any different, but or any easier. But it's definitely just probably different.
Yeah.
You definitely – our injuries are more the road rash,
torn muscles.
Like, and your injuries are more –
What is road rash?
Cold muscles, which – road rash. So it's just when you slide on riding, you're doing the race, riding 35 miles per hour, and
you just crash your skin.
And slide on the gravel.
Oh, I thought it was that, but I was like,
yeah.
It's chronic injuries for us – chronic injuries.
Yeah, me and Tyler just our bodies are just full of
that. But yeah, that's the upside of cycling is it's fairly easy on your body. Minus like you lose your bone density.
Right.
Wow. Well, thanks. I've really appreciated this conversation, man. I think it was really enlightening.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you guys having me on. I mean, I think this stuff is important, and I think the more and more we do things like this, the easier the conversations are, and the more people are comfortable, saying black, saying that,
another trust is built for sure.
Like that's all reality, and it's just a conversation that so many people have avoided for so long, and for understandable reasons, but I think the more and more we have these kind of conversations, the quicker we'll see change and better off we'll be. So I appreciate you guys having me on, no doubt.
Yeah.
No, thank you so much, Kenny. Thanks for your honesty. Thanks for your openness. Thanks for your love. Thanks for being you on social media. I mean, without you being you on social media,
absolutely.
Maybe I wouldn't have felt as comfortable to reach out to you, And so just thanks for being you, man. We love having you on the show and, I can't wait to see you again, hopefully at another photo shoot or something sometime soon when this stuff clears up, dude. So you're a pleasure to talk to on the phone, but I mean in person, man. No! The guy, he can chow down great Korean barbecue and he just
I appreciate that. You as well,
good conversation,
well.
Man.
Oh, how can we awesome. So real quick,
so well, all right, guys.
Hopefully people will want to follow your goal toward the Olympics. So how can people best follow that?
Yeah.
So, I mean, my Instagram is pretty much where I put everything. So Kenny Selman, KNNY_Selman, SELMON. On my Instagram, I put pretty much everything there. It's very active during the season. It's less active, obviously, when
for 2 months.
Not doing all those meetings. Right, yeah, for those 2 months.
Those 2 months, he's chilling. He's just in his swimsuit in Mexico, just relaxing.
I am
margaritas on margaritas.
Because I have been training for so long, and I am I'm very good as far as, I'm blocking the bad stuff
very good.
When I'm training, but trust me, I'm ready to get active.
Yeah, right on. Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it, dude. Thanks so much. All right, guys. Thanks again for another great week. We'll catch you guys next.